Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Before we go any further, I'll read out the notices. There are two people here who've come all the way from Australia.
Please, Craig and Lucas.
Declare yourself.
Can you identify?
Come on.
Here we are. Great work.
Look at that. All the way from Australia. A massive
expense.
Just
to be here tonight.
Just to be here.
Just to be here tonight.
In fact, one of the reasons we're getting on with it is they've got a flight to catch back to Australia. Later this evening. Okay, welcome back to the second part of the show. There was a time, and it's not that long ago, when if you wanted to compile a list of striking books written by musicians of a popular kind, you get to Ian Hunter's Diary of a Rock Star. You might go Graham Parker's The Wrong Trousers. Do you remember that one?
I've read all these.
And after that, you'd be scratching your head, you know. But that's all changed in the last 10 years or so, when there's been, you know, an enormous number of books written by musicians, generally autobiographical books, from Keith Richards and Bob Dylan on down. And if you have to point out a weakness of a lot of these books, I always get the feeling that they're kind of written index first. You know what I mean? That they start with, can you get a load of names in here? Now, can you get an anecdote about absolutely every one of those names?
And in precise chronological order.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, our guest here has written two highly acclaimed books, which you can't say that about at all, because they're about real life. And, you know, his career as a distinguished member of Everything But the Girl, and as a solo artist and a producer and a guy running a record company, sort of doesn't matter to the appeal of the book. And when we were actually exchanging emails some while ago, when we first of all tried to set up this quite a while ago, I said, my wife's read your book, and she doesn't even know who you are. and I realised it's an appalling thing to say, because I managed to offend both my wife and our distinguished guest. They're both here this evening. I hope they'll both forgive me.
Your wife's walked out, I see.
But up here, would you please welcome Ben Watt?
Thank you.
Now, we're going to be talking mainly about Romany and Tom this evening.
Right.
The book. And you're going to read us a bit.
I'll read a couple of pages just to set the tone. I thought I'd read a bit from the middle of the book. My parents are in their 70s at this point, and I've tried to bring them up to London for one sort of last hurrah, and it's all gone a bit wrong. And my mum's actually got very ill and has ended up in hospital. And my dad, who is basically a depressed alcoholic, is unable to sort of look after himself. And we've had to put him into a local care home while my mum's in the hospital, while we all decide what to do. And this is a story of something that happened to my dad while he was staying at the care home in North London. On a busy stretch of the Finchley Road, a few doors down from the Secrets Table and Pole Dancing Club and the Thai Siam Health and Beauty Bar, stands a large boarded-up sports bar called the 317. It was once a three-story Victorian pub called the Carney Arms, and at weekends, before it folded in the wake of an underage drinking scandal, it doubled as a pre-club evening night spot with DJs playing funky, sexy house music for buff lads on the pull and girls on their way up west. There were pool tables and big-screen broadcasts, although during the week, most of the 16 satellite TV screens scattered around the venue were blank, and the upstairs and basement roped off. And the clientele corralled onto the ground floor in the mid-afternoons would change to companionless off-shift waiters on their way to the bookies and a few unaccompanied professional drinkers. It was here on a January lunchtime in 2003 that my dad, accompanied by a blind man and a chef, both from the same care home where he was staying, escaped for a celebratory drink to mark the new year. Now, the exit doors at the care home needed a manually entered key code before they would open onto a narrow brick driveway set back about 10 feet from the pavement. My dad didn't know the code, and I don't suppose the blind man did, but I'm sure the chef could do it in his sleep. The section of the Finchley Road outside the door is a red route, double red lines, no stopping at any time. The noise can be quite startling when it's busy. Four car lanes and two bus lanes of delivery lorries, skip hire trucks, double deckers, cars, coaches, and white transits all jostling like jockeys in the final furlong for that extra yard of space. The 317 is about 200 yards away from the care home. It sounds near, but my dad, with his bad lungs, had been finding a short walk up and down the corridor was about enough most mornings. Not only that, but the bar is situated on the other side of the road, across a box junction and a couple of potholes, where the Pelican crossings need smart decision-making once the pedestrian signal flashes green. By the time the three of them arrived, my dad was gulping for air. He made it through the front door, took a few tottering steps, and then collapsed on the carpet. You might have thought that at this point, the chef, an employee at a care home, after all, would have realised how reckless he had been and sprinted back for help. But no. Instead, he and a member of the bar staff propped my dad up against a fruit machine and gave him a glass of whiskey to revive him. The effect on his brain, already dangerously short of oxygen, must have been nothing short of psychedelic. But more by luck than judgment, his heart didn't stop, and they got him upright and seated on a bar stool. My dad, to his credit, composed himself and got his breath back. Everyone cracked a couple of jokes, and then, quite remarkably, they all got to the front door and somehow managed to walk back. I suppose you must have some sympathy for my dad. As a persistent drinker, he must have found the enforced sobriety at the care home, well, unless you count the evening sherry, hard to bear. The drop in blood alcohol levels must, at the very least, have brought on mild withdrawal symptoms and cravings. And with no emergency sugar substitutes readily to hand, the Coca-Cola, the bars of chocolate, the dried fruit, it must have all got too much, especially when a young, companionable chef was rolling back the years before him. Of course, when I found out, I confronted the care home and expressed my outrage in the strongest possible terms, and there were unstinting apologies. But apart from moving him somewhere else, which in itself would have been even more disruptive for him, I realised there was little else I could do. I had no legal charge over him. He was still a grown-up. The care home had adequate security measures in place on the front door, which were circumvented in extremely unusual circumstances. And I could no more control events than I could stop him going back to bed all day. Perhaps I should have insisted on the chef's dismissal, but that seemed overly hysterical. And anyway, I considered that was up to them. When it all blew over, I realised I actually secretly admired my dad for the sheer audacity of his escape. And it occurred to me that I had felt many things for him over the years. Admiration, respect, anger, disdain. But overarching all of it was a long, indecipherable allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the book, Romany and Tom, which, as I say, was your second autobiographical writing.
A memoir is the word you're
memoir,
looking for, David.
That's, and it's a considerably easier word than the one I use.
Easy for you to say.
Easy for you to say. What were the big challenges about? You know, you've been working in music. Where, you know, some people say that music is really good because it kind of suits short attention spans. You know, you do things quickly. Whereas one of the really impressive things about your writing is the amount of detail, and the amount of observation. Do you go about it in a very different way? Have you always taken notes all the way through?
No, I don't really keep notebooks. I've always had a very strong photographic memory. I mean, it's something that is a bit of an issue between me and Tracy, in that I can often remember the colour of people's shoes, but I don't often remember anniversaries and things like that.
So I
do have a strong observational visual eye. I've always had that, but I think a lot of it is just, there's a lot of hard work that goes on behind the scenes. You know, it's like the legs of the swan below the surface. And I just put in a lot of work into it. I began with my own memories for this book, but then I did a lot of detailed research, and I realised that to bring it to life, you know, I had to really colour the page. And I went back to places that I was writing about. I took photographs.
Particular place, you went back.
Yes,
there
several times.
Out,
so. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Several times.
Yeah, I actually the distance between the care home and the 317 I actually found on Google Maps. Okay. So I mean, you know, you just use different techniques to sort of get all the detail together. But it becomes quite forensic, and you start laying out all the facts in front of you, and then I find that once it's all there, that kind of infrastructure of detail, then I'm able to write quite freely.
Quite quickly. The book writes itself to a certain extent because you've got so much
and I think
to put in.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Richard Ford, the novelist, once, and he was saying that when he prepares his books, he has a folder with different sections in it for the different characters, and whenever he thinks of a detail or an aspect of their life, he just slots it in, and gradually this folder gets bigger and bigger. And then when he comes to actually write the characters, there's so much background information that he's pre-prepared. And I really recognise that. I mean, I think it's something that I do as well.
The remark I made earlier about my wife not having heard of you, you know, you must have found with both these books that being read by loads of people who didn't know anything about your music.
Yeah.
Is that very gratifying?
Well, of course. You know, I hate that sort of... It's like pre-preparation. Sometimes people come at your work. And I love the idea that they come at it fresh. Because I certainly enjoy discovering people for the first time. I'm always looking for something new. I don't expect any airs and graces with what I've done. I like to, you know, impress people just with the work itself. So it's actually quite exciting, I think.
Now, you've sent us a bunch of pictures from your family album, I suppose, which might help colour it in for anybody who hasn't read the book, and particularly people who have read the book will want to know more.
You should actually give us a little sketch. There they are.
I was going to say, we'll start with this is Romany.
Your parents are so unimaginably glamorous to me. You know,
so introduce them.
Just to explain what they did for a living. It is absolutely astonishing, the world that you grew up in.
Well, this picture is taken in the early 60s. My dad grew up as a working class boy in Glasgow in the 20s and 30s. His father worked in the local steelworks as a foreman. His mother was a housewife. No one in his family was at all musical. But he discovered the music of Tommy Dorsey and dreamed of being a jazz musician. And when he left school at 15, that's what he wanted to be. And to his parents' credit, they got a piano for him at home that he was able to practice on. And he managed to blag a gig with the Jack Chapman Band, then went into the Air Force. And when he came out of the Air Force in the mid-40s, he went straight to London. It was that sort of social mobility that enabled people to move right after the war. And he had a series of jobs playing the piano in bands in the West End. And then in the mid-50s, he ran into his old friend from the Air Force, Brian Ricks, the actor manager, who made a lot of money as an actor in the Whitehall Farces, but was also a huge jazz fan. And basically bankrolled my dad's first jazz orchestra demos, which is what my dad really wanted to do.
Your godfather, too.
And my godfather as well, he is now. And actually, Brian is now inserted into my middle name, which has never actually thrilled me, but...
There's always a downside. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to be Benjamin Thomas Watt after my dad, but Brian was just slipped in there at the last minute. For other reasons, which the book will also make clear... So Brian bankrolled my dad's demos. The demos, my dad put together this kind of crack jazz orchestra and impressed the BBC almost instantly with it, and sort of out of nowhere became this huge success story, basically, in the late 50s on the London jazz scene. He got his own show on the BBC. He had his own band playing at Quaglino's in the evenings. And it was all very glamorous. He was the youngest band leader in London in 1957. My mother, conversely, had a very middle-class upbringing. Her father was a Methodist parson who went on to become a very well-known radio broadcaster. He was like a sort of latter-day David Attenborough. He basically constructed the first nature programmes on the BBC. This is in the late 30s, where they'd artificially recreate rambles through the countryside, and he would describe the animals that he would come across with these two schoolgirls who would travel with him. It was actually all done in the studio, but the audience all thought it was actually recorded out in the field. And the two schoolgirls were actually two 40-year-old women putting their voices on, called Muriel and Doris. And they, you know, they'd say things like, oh look, Romany, a little hedgehog through the brambles. And all that. Actually, they're 40-year-old women. It's rather strange, isn't it? But there we go.
In a tray of gravel. Yeah.
But the thing that brought my parents together was that they were both in loveless marriages. My mother actually married the famous theatre critic Richard Findlater, who discovered John Osborne and wrote for Tribune and then went on to edit The Observer. She was trying to become an actress herself. She acted with what was to become the RSC, but then found herself pregnant first with one child and then with triplets in the early 50s, which kind of put paid to her career. And she also realised that she didn't love her husband very much. My dad was also stuck in a marriage which wasn't going anywhere. And I think by their early 30s, which is when they met, they just felt deprived in many ways, certainly in terms of passion. And I think we're at a very interesting point in social history at that point as well, where, you know, the idea of kind of marriage as something out of duty was being replaced by, you know, the sense from the late 50s and the late 60s of where self becomes important.
There's actually, talking about your mother's theatrical career,
and, yeah.
The picture on the left taken by the famous Angus McBean.
Yes.
The legendary theatrical photographer.
Yes. I think we say McBain, don't we?
Do we? Well,
yes.
I stand corrected.
Dave, come on. Memoir, McBain.
No, no, no. took the picture on the cover of the first Beatles.
Yeah, though. Terrific.
So what was she doing there?
Well, this is my mum. In fact, what I was just talking about, her first big break was when she acted with a theatre company that just preceded the RSC at the Memorial Theatre in Stratford. And she was in her mid-20s looking for a lucky break, and she got basically walk-on parts in a 66-strong company with only six women, and found herself acting alongside Peggy Ashcroft and John Gielgud, directed by Anthony Hopkins.
Who she dances with, doesn't she?
She dances
the book,
with Gielgud.
Right up to the very end, she said, I danced with Sir John.
Yeah, still one of her strong memories, even now, with dementia.
Even now, that's
right. Yeah. And this was taken in 1950 while she was there at Stratford.
And then she went on to work for...
Change of career.
Yes, but as a journalist.
Well, this is the interesting thing. My dad's career, which we can talk about later, as we know, went into decline as sort of pop kicked jazz into the long grass. And whilst he was unable to sort of recover himself in some way, my mum did manage to reinvent herself as a showbiz writer and became very successful as a feature writer, writing for She magazine and Cosmopolitan from the early 60s onwards. And by the late 60s, she was becoming really given quite glamorous assignments. Here she is with Goldie Hawn and George Hamilton IV in Hollywood. This is, I think, in the very late 60s. And it was around this time that she managed to secure exclusives with Burton and Taylor. And they basically paid for my upbringing.
And also gives, at one point, gives Elizabeth Taylor the scarf. Is it your great-grandmother's scarf?
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
you then, what happened that you saw it in the magazine? Was something a picture of Taylor?
Well, she'd already struck up a relationship with Richard Burton. She'd interviewed him a couple of times. And she always played up the kind of wild Welsh gypsy. Her mother had Welsh heritage. And, of course, Burton was Welsh. So whenever she went to interview him, she would dress up in these quite sort of outrageous, wild
gypsy
costumes.
Yes.
Like you do, you know. And and so when she went out to interview him in Mexico in 1970, she took her wild Welsh gypsy outfit with her and pre-prepared...
outfit.
She laid the ground. She was quite smart. She took out this gypsy scarf that had belonged to my great-grandmother. And sure enough, Liz Taylor at one point during the interview made a big fuss about tracing her heritage and perhaps her... She was very dark-skinned, you know, dark hair. Did she have gypsy background? And my mother, at the end, presented her with this gypsy scarf as a, you know, present. Very clever.
I know, brilliant.
All of it.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Have you got something for me, I hope?
Sorry?
You've got something for me.
See, she goes away on these trips to interview fantastically famous people. Was she a bit starstruck?
I think, yes. I mean, I think she's always loved the glamorous side of showbiz. But, you know, she sees it from the inside because she was an actress herself. But, no, she always loved it. And it was the same when me and Tracy were travelling and touring a lot with the band. She would always love the whole backstage yes. machinations, and she would always insist on coming to the gig through the stage door. She right. wouldn't...
She was bothered.
Waving to imaginary
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
You would. You did yeah. well, would you?
And then she would go and take her seat out in the stalls and watch festooned in Everything But the Girl badges. And,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And then would reappear afterwards in the dressing room, you know, and with her camera, and would take endless photographs of whoever was there for posterity.
And sell them to She magazine.
Yeah. And she would annotate them all in her scrapbooks. So there's photos of me and Tracy backstage with little post-it notes
oh, lovely.
Pointing to someone's roadie and, you know, the drummer's grandma.
Right, or yeah. she knew who they
yeah,
were.
Yeah, she'd worked them all
so
out.
So those are pictures of your mother, and I think what we have next is... this is
Ah, there we go, yeah.
You described that very
your
picture
father
in the book, yes.
In,
that's him there.
That's yeah. him there.
Yeah.
So where's that taken and when?
That's Quaglino's, which is his first big gig in London, 1957. He was actually booked just to be the pianist in the incoming quintet that was taking over from the outgoing band. And you must realize Quaglino's was the place to be in terms of kind of high society and sort of glamorous cocktail living. When this is the post-war years, it's still full of austerity. So, you know, it was a real golden ticket, this place. And my dad was asked to be the pianist in the band, but with sheer force of character and charisma, he sort of convinced the management that what they needed was, as he called it, the new music. And they said, well, how do we get this new music? And he said, well, I'm the person to give it to you. And basically had the whole quintet renamed the Tommy Watt Quintet and talked Quaglino's into letting him lead the band. And there he is with his five-piece band. And this is probably some MP or
right,
Lord
yes.
or something, you know. I don't know. I've always wanted to know who that is. If anyone ever finds out who that photo is, tell me.
But it's kind of very fascinating that he's this absolutely at the top of his game. Here we are, in fact, there's a poster. Mm. And obviously the Beatles arrive and pop music comes in, rock and roll, and his position is threatened by that.
Yeah.
But he will not adapt, will he? He refused. I mean, he's offered extraordinary jobs, wasn't he? Wasn't he offered a job, some arrangement job with the Beatles?
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, it's incredible.
So go on, what happened? He was offered?
Well, he was signed by George Martin, who just obviously prior to the Beatles was doing jazz and all sorts of music on Parlophone. And then George came up to my dad at one point and said, I've just discovered these four lads from Liverpool who I think are going to go somewhere. Would you like to do the arrangements? And my dad had a listen and said, well, it's just not for me.
Rubbish.
You know,
right. Yeah. Never catch on.
Yeah. I think he's
very wise, actually.
I think the trouble is, I think my dad sensed it would catch on, but he resisted and felt that somehow if there was enough of a resistance movement, that somehow they could, in a Canute-like kind of way...
Hold it back.
It's brilliant.
And he couldn't have done it at all.
No.
It's extraordinary, this old post that you sent me. I mean, this is like... It's like the early 80s at the Wag Club, isn't
it? It is, very much.
Louis Rondeau à la Turque,
yeah.
Yeah,
you
really.
Yeah.
And look at the venue here. The National Union of Tailors and Garment Workers.
Long gone.
Yeah.
It's around the corner from here.
Charles Square. So was he bitter about that change that took place?
I think he was, yes. Secretly, although he tried to never let on too much. He always kept his powder dry and... I think he accepted that it was there. He was always very jealous of the kind of arrangers who managed to survive through it. People like Quincy Jones, Pat Williams, a lot of the big American arrangers who managed to somehow, you know, still maintain their dignity and strength. Even through the jazz years. But for British jazz, it was very different.
It's really sad that at one point he finished up playing piano in the pit at the Bournemouth Winter Garden.
Yeah.
So I can't remember, he's not even supporting the main act, is he?
No.
Who is he? He's waiting for Bruce Forsyth comes on.
Well, this was, in 1970, he had one last great roll of the dice when the Dorchester came to him.
That's it, yeah.
And said, you know, we want to revive the big band sound and we want you to lead the band. And my dad was given... the opportunity to put together a 9-piece orchestra and write all the arrangements. And I write about this really vividly in the book because it's one of my strongest, childhood memories. With coming home from school, and my dad every day would be writing these arrangements, and I'd hear the piano in the house. And then, of course, the actual the residency starts at the Dorchester, and it's an absolute disaster. And it's just little old ladies up from Eastbourne coming up for a tea dance to... hear some Glenn Miller, you know, and it's... The whole thing fell apart within about 6 to 8 weeks, and my dad was heartbroken. And you're right, immediately after that, he was just accepting work that was thrown at him, and he ended up playing the piano in the pit orchestra at the Bournemouth Winter Garden, playing piano for the Beverly Sisters.
That's
and,
it, yeah.
You know, comic routines by Hope and Keane. And anyone remember Hope and Keane?
Yes.
Very early 70s.
Yeah.
You know, double act. There was one great moment he actually had when he was actually given the job as MD for Tommy Cooper in Scarborough, which he does look back on as one of the funniest... Well, he did look back on one of the funniest 3 months of his life. And I went up to see him when he was up there. And even I, at that age, and I can only have been about 7, found the whole thing absolutely marvellous and hilarious and thought Tommy Cooper was fantastic. And the whole band were always just killing themselves every night. It was great to watch.
But did you also, you know, growing up, when your father was going through these disappointments, did you also pick up something that most non-musicians growing up wouldn't pick up? The kind of the toughness and the humiliation that can be involved in the musician's loss, you know what I mean? That things can go badly wrong and people come home miserable because nobody's turned up and all that kind of thing. Did you absorb any of that kind of stuff?
I think probably I did. And I certainly realised that humility was an important, you know, card to play when it comes to music, and not to expect too much, and that, you know, the tables can turn just as soon as they turn in your favour, they can turn the other way.
Right.
perhaps I didn't articulate it like that when I was 18, but it was probably in the back of my mind because I'd certainly seen it with my dad. Yeah.
But you were sort of rooted in a... Oh, sorry, we're going on.
No, go on.
I was going to say you were just rooted in a kind of showbiz kind of world. Your mother sort of comes back with all these autographs, these people that she's interviewed, you know, Noel Edmonds.
Yeah, Noel Edmonds.
It's really
nice
that you collect these autographs.
Yeah, James Galway.
James Galway, the man with the golden flute. Yeah, absolutely.
Wings.
Who else at school's got one of those?
Yes.
That's right.
Because you were living... Where were you living at the... I don't know, at the time of these pictures? Is this Barnes?
This is Barnes in southwest London.
See,
yes.
it's quite a idyllic existence, it appears to be. And you were living in a road with loads of quite well placed people.
Well, we lived in the flat. We had the top two floors. We're in the garden here, but actually, the brick wall that you can see there is actually the flat to my grandmother, who lived on the ground floor, and we had the top two floors, the flat above. But in the summer, we'd come down and use the garden. And that's my mum actually writing some feature there. That's all. She's got her work with her. And this is the football kit from one of my older brothers after England won the World Cup. And I'm still wearing it about 3 years later in 1969.
Keep the dream alive.
Yeah. This ball actually went out of shape because it was left near the incinerator in the garden. And it never rolled straight on the lawn. But it was the only one I was allowed to play with.
So what was life like in Barnes at that time growing up?
Well, it was a very media, what you'd call a media road now. And looking back, I mean, the people who I grew up alongside, it was an extraordinary collection of people. Everyone in the road, looking back, seemed to be somebody. On my right-hand side was John Kentish, who was an opera singer at Sadler's Wells. On the right was Basil Davidson, who was a famous African historian. Then there was one of the editors at the Daily Telegraph. Then there was the man who launched London Weekend Television. Then there was the family of Augustus John, the post-impressionist painter, whose son was Caspar John, who was first Sea Lord at the Admiralty. And all these people lived in the road, and it was... fairly bohemian and kind of, you know, yeah.
How did your parents feel about living amongst those people?
Well, I think my dad always had a very strong kind of working class, slight socialist chip on his shoulder about it all. And certainly he had no time for the editor of the Daily Telegraph, for example. And he was always slightly, you know... He slightly looked down on it all. He thought it was all a little bit poncy, really. And he preferred to spend his time in the public bar at the Bull's Head with plumbers and drummers and...
Right.
Because that was more the kind of person he was.
So you got half brothers and so forth, but you were brought up as an only child there.
Effectively, yeah. I mean, my half-brothers and sisters from my mum's first marriage to Richard Findlater... we all lived together, so I grew up with them. But then where my memories start, which is where I'm about 7 or 8, they're already in their late teens and about to leave home and go to university and stuff. So certainly my teenage years were very much...
Which is presumably why there's such an incredibly high level of observation of your parents. Because had you had brothers and sisters, you would probably have ignored your parents and played with them, I don't know. But it's so extraordinary how much you've noticed what they did and remembered...
Yeah, and I think I was encouraged to be an adult quite early as well. I don't remember my childhood being particularly indulged. I was well loved. I'm not looking back saying it was tough in that sense, emotionally tough, but it was quite robust. You know, I was expected to laugh at my dad's jokes quite early on.
It's the same in my family, isn't it?
Yeah. So then you go on, you leave and you go to university and so forth, and you've made a record on your own, and you meet Tracy, who's made records with a group and so forth, and you get together and you have success, more success than your father ever had in the music business. How do your parents feel about your success?
Well, they both approached it very differently. I mean, my mum... As I talked about coming to the gig, she loved all of it. She was just thrilled. You know, it was showbiz. You know, it was a different kind of showbiz, but let's face it, it was still showbiz.
Yeah.
And she clipped out all of the reviews and the cuttings and kept scrapbooks and would always ask me how the notices were for our albums. You know,
that was great.
Yes. The New Musical Express.
Yes, the notices in the Melody Maker.
Rave notices.
Yes. And my dad was always much more conflicted. And I think it was because, you know, on the one hand, he was very pleased that I'd made a career as a musician. I mean, that was a great plus point in his eyes. But, of course, I was making a success in the very area of music that he'd rejected and that had kicked him out of the way. So it was difficult for him. And I think, you know, I think what one of the big problems lies in the difference between jazz and pop, if you like. I mean, jazz is very much about self-expression allied with technique, and pop is very much about self-expression allied with lack of technique,
right.
Or yeah. Concept, let's say,
yeah, yeah.
You know, where concept is as important as anything else. And I think, looking back, he very much liked our records where technique was more married with self-expression. So he loved the first record, Eden, where I'd written all these horn arrangements. And he loved the album we made in L.A. in the late 80s with Michael Brecker and Stan Getz. But the more conceptual records, like we're going into Abbey Road, Dad, to record an album with an orchestra, and it's going to sound like Patsy Cline meets Dusty Springfield. He just went, why? You know, he just didn't quite understand why we
wanted
to do that.
What did they think about the self-expression, what were the things you wrote about and the lyrics? Because that's something you're always very self-conscious about in the presence of your parents.
Yeah, My mum picked up on the lyrics much quicker than my dad, and she realised that that was really what the band was about. It was as much about what we were, you know, singing as what we were playing. It took my dad a lot longer to catch on. I think it was about 3 or 4 albums in before he realised that there were actually something going on in the lyrics. And then I gave him the song that I wrote about him, which was The Night I Heard Caruso Sing. And I said to him, Dad, this is about the trip we made up to Scotland, and I've written it for you. And that was when the penny dropped with him, and he realised that, there's more to this
right.
than meets the eye. So
Yeah. So here you are with your with mum and dad in what years are we talking about there?
So this is...
Who's that above you there on the left?
Here?
Yes, above...
So this is my mum.
Sorry, I thought your mum over there.
No, this is my mum.
Yeah.
And my dad, and that's my half-sister Jenny.
That's it, yeah.
So this is 1993, and I describe this photo in some detail in the book. One of my favourite pictures, actually. And this is only about a year since I came out of hospital, having got through... my battle with Churg-Strauss syndrome at the Westminster Hospital. And this is about a year later. And my dad, who's been battling with depression and drinking, has actually been on the wagon after a mini stroke that he suffered while driving his car. And they all came up to visit me and Tracy in London. And we had some, I think it was a Sunday lunch we had together. And we went for a walk, and this is taken on Hampstead Heath. It's October, and the trees are turning. And Tracy, who's a self-confessed technophobe, took the photograph, which I really love.
Because it's a very happy picture.
Well, it is. And I, as I say in the book, I mean, I love my dad in that. In many ways, and I realise that a lot of the photos I like best of my dad are when he's sober in them, and he is there. I think my mum looks like a resistance fighter as well. I kind of picture her as that in her later years as well. And that's my lovely sister, half sister Jenny, who died so sadly a couple of years ago.
So did you, was drinking or was it was a big issue, was it, with them as you were growing up?
Well, I think it was part of that generation, you know, and I think it was, you know, it was a very social thing. You know, hours of the day were marked by a drink.
And how could you be a jazz musician in Soho and not drink?
And, you know, it's very much a part of his culture. Yeah. But I think, you know, the thing that acts as a loosener, if you like, you know, both in society and in your work, starts to become something you rely on as you get older. And they couldn't, particularly my dad, couldn't shake off the drinking. And it became allied to his depression, and the two started to weld together. And this was the, you know, the great issue going forward. He became more and more insular and more isolated, stayed at home, became quite paranoid. And my mother, God bless her, you know, battled away for years trying to keep it all going and keep a life for herself going. She kept writing until her late 60s. I mean, she was still doing travel pieces for The Observer and The Guardian and into her late 60s. But towards the end, ended up with that slight thing, if you can't beat them, join them. And ended up drinking a bit like my dad into her 70s, which is when I sort of started to take, well, tried to take control of them. And that's really where the book begins, as they sort of slightly lose control of themselves.
I love the way the time
changes. But it is the kind of classic narrative that people jokingly say, you know, that you start off as, you know, you have to look after your parents like you used to look after your children.
Mm.
Was it like that?
Of course. Well, I didn't. It's the last thing I thought it would be like, stupidly. I thought I could control it. And I thought that by bringing them up to London, you know, relieving them of this sort of self-independence, self-determination, I could control them in some way. You know, it was foolish. And they were basically like two truculent children. And I also realised that it was a step too far, you know, particularly for my dad. I'd taken them out of a comfort zone. They'd been in Oxford, where they'd been living for 12 years. Suddenly threw them into a whole brand new environment, a new flat. You know, my mum had to get used to new shops and all this kind of stuff, and a new GP and, you know, all the basics I didn't really pay enough attention to. And it threw them, really. And I think their decline was actually much quicker than I thought it would be.
Was your going back into the past an attempt to kind of get a greater understanding of who they were? Because I love the way the book goes further and further back into your ancestry. At one point you get to, I think, your great-great-grandfather, who's, I think, more than one of his children die of smallpox, and this was in the mid-19th century. Mm. Is that early 19th century? No. I mean, when you started to write the book, did you set out to go back that far, or did that just develop through the course of exploring who your parents were?
I think it came as I tried to flesh out their characters more, and particularly the contrasting backgrounds. And my mother's Romani background and Gypsy background was, I think, quite important to her character, and that's why I went back into that. But my great-great uncle was Gypsy Smith, who was a famous evangelical preacher. He was like kind of latter-day Billy Graham. And this is in the 20s where, you know, evangelizing Methodism was at its peak. And he was an incredibly charismatic live performer, basically. I wonder where I get it from. You know? Sorry, I mean the live performer bit, not the charismatic bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would talk for hours to tens of thousands of people in these great tabernacles. And at one point, he talked to 40,000 people in Times Square in New York.
Incredible.
So, yeah, that was really to flesh out their characters. But
there's another really touching thing that you say very early on about how the modern world is so documented. You know, everything is just being recorded constantly. There's just text, and there's emails, and there's Instagrams. You know, and you're going back and looking at a world where very, very little is. It remains. It's very touching when you find these little analog letters, you know, from your mother about her relationship with her father, which you open up and feel you're picking the lock into some kind of a safe that you shouldn't even be looking into. And it's true that in a sort of digital 21st century, those things are really precious and need to be recorded.
Yeah,
and that's probably one of the reasons you went back and did all that research.
Yes, and you know, as I said before, it does become. It becomes like very important forensic evidence because you have so little of it. So certainly the collection of letters that my mother kept, you know, I pored over for hours, rereading and reading, you know, scraping them for all the detail in a lot of cases. And what was amazing was that she kept, particularly through the years of her affair with my dad, all the letters from her first husband, Ken, which are just as dramatic and beautiful and written in a completely different tone to that of my parents. And I realised I was able to, like, weave these other characters' stories in and really make it about, you know...
Did they know that you were
writing
about them?
A whole cast of characters. Well, no. I mean, my dad had died. He died in 2006, which is really what got me started on the whole idea of writing the book. And then by the time I actually embarked on it in seriousness, which was 2012... my mum, by that stage, was suffering, you know, advanced stages of dementia. So, I mean, I go and see her still regularly, and she has moments of lucidity. And I've showed her the copy of the book.
I was going to say, have you shown
her? Yeah, no, I've said, you know, your mum, I go, look, you know, here you are, look, this is you in Mexico, 1970. And this book, it's all about you. And then I showed her the reviews from some of the papers. And she said, in the papers, darling? That's where I like to be.
Any good notices? That was perfect.
Well, you read your book, which is less dramatic than this, but your mother was showing off about it.
Oh, she was. Sorry, yes. At a tangent. My mother's also in an old folks' home. And I think you have to develop, I don't know if anybody else is, because a mother of mine, mother's about to be 97, actually. It's very touching in a way. You have to develop a kind of humour about it because it's very sad when they become so confused. But on a happier note, I ring up my mother before I go and see her to remind her I'm coming to see her, and then I ring up the next morning to say I'm just setting off. And when I get there 45 minutes later, thrilled, surprised. You know, and it's really sweet. Hello, darling. What are you doing? I just come to see you. But anyway, the embarrassing thing is, and I hope your mother isn't the same, she leaves a copy of my book literally on the table. Oh, that old thing. No, not in the papers yet. No, sorry. Anyway.
Now, this is a picture obviously taken later. When are we talking about there?
So this is, I think, around 2004. So I've brought them up to London. It's all gone a bit wrong. And they tried a few months in the two of them in the care home in London that I read about in the book earlier on. And it was too expensive and not the place we wanted them to be in a few other different ways. And Rowley, who is my half-brother, the chap in the middle there, he suggested, why don't they come down to this place near where I live, which is near Bristol, north of Bristol, which had some very good reports. And so this is just after we've moved them into the Bristol care home in 2004. So this is a couple of years before my dad died. And that's the room that, look, you can even see an Everything But the Girl Eden poster
wonderful.
On the wall behind
fantastic.
Them, which my mother would have insisted putting up, even when she was at that age. So,
how do you feel about it all now when you look back? I mean, you know, most people. Do you feel you did everything you could? And
I do, and perhaps I was naive in some ways, thinking that I could, you know, exert some control over them when they came up to London. But at the same time, they were in such desperate straits in Oxford. My mum was really losing the battle. It was a terrible house to live in physically as well. There were too many stairs. My dad was very immobile. Apart from his depression, he also was suffering from, well, for want of a better word, emphysema. It was a COAD, obstructive pulmonary disease. So, coupled with his drinking and his depression and this appalling bronchitis, he was very housebound, and something had to be done. But, you know, I feel that I did everything I could. And, you know, Rowley has been marvellous as well in these later years, particularly with my mum. He visits her very regularly because he's nearby. So, you know, we still put the hours in. And
So it did strike me, reading your book, that actually we're the first generation and they are actually at the business end of this, to really experience this idea of old age. You know, I mean, people didn't used to live this long. I mean, the last of my grandparents died when I was three. Mm. You know, they were in their late 60s. Nobody got in a great state about it. That was considered to be a really good innings, you know.
Yeah.
So we are, you and everybody, all of us, are learning huge amounts about a whole world we don't know much about, which is people having lives up to the 100, you know.
I think, you know, in years gone by, you know, people of the age of my parents by this stage would have got pneumonia or would have had a fall, you know, which is usually the one that leads to hospitalisation.
But the miracle of modern medicine is often, you know.
Yes, and, you know, my mother now lives in the newly built wing of this care home in Bristol. It's absolutely bulletproof, you know. Nothing's going to kill her in it, you know. And, you know, it's marvellous in some ways that she's still alive, but at the same time, I'm very aware that she sort of wishes that it would end now. You know, she's outlived my dad by 8 years. She's got dementia. You know, she's aware that her life is
And very
not
sweetly,
much
she
fun.
Thinks that your dad is one of the on the board of directors of the care home.
That was a period she went through, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
This is rather touching, really. Nice to think of him in such a controlling, responsible position.
Yeah.
some of the things he's done in his life.
Well, I mean, her dementia's taken various forms over the years, some of it not quite as humorous. I mean, at one stage, just after my dad died, it was difficult because she kept... At first, she saw him returning through the wall of her room. And I used to say to her, "How do you see him, Mum?" And she said he was always so well dressed, and he was always dressed in the clothes that he was wearing when they first had their affair as this 60s band leader.
Oh.
And that was the point in the book where I realised I could actually use that as a kind of a method of telling the story of their affair as she witnesses this ghost, you know, of her husband come back dressed like that. But then very quickly it all got difficult because she suffers from this form of dementia which has these quite vivid hallucinations, and it wasn't long before he was a skeleton under the bed and all this kind of stuff, and it was very complex. But yes, the period that you talk about, she was actually envisaging him as on the board at the...
yeah, I think that's... quite a compliment. Really.
Yeah.
The books obviously had great acclaim. It's nominated for the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
When do you get to know whether you've won that?
I think the short... It's on the long list, and then the short list, I think, is October.
Right. If there's any justice, it's going to be on the short list.
I think the final... award is November.
Right. Mm. Yeah, now, you had presumably lots of good feedback. You must have had lots of good feedback from people who's similarly placed with their own parents. Is that true?
I think a lot of people have written to me and said that they've read the book and it's made them reassess their relationship with their parents, and particularly the life... Well, two things. Their life with their parents now, the years that are left to them with their parents, but also the life of their parents before they were born, and using that as a method to understand their parents more now, which is very much, you know, the idea I had to kick the book off, this idea that, you know, we only tend to see the second half of our parents' lives, which is the downhill part, and the golden years of our parents' lives, we actually have to go back and piece together, and when we look into it, we realise that was very much the thing that defined them. There were moments in there which made them up. And actually, the very first line of the book, the preface, that line about the golden years, I actually put on Twitter back in early... I suppose it was late 2011, early 2012. I virtually put the whole line of the book on Twitter because it struck me as an idea. And I got such a response. I thought, this is really good, you know, and it became the driver for the beginning of the book.
Wonderful piece of instant market research.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Instant market research.
Now, so there's the book, and it's an extraordinary piece of work, Ben. It really is.
Thank
it's
you.
Absolutely
yeah.
terrific.
It's fantastic.
You're now back to your musical career.
Yes.
You're about to go on tour, is that right?
Yes. back out on tour, yes.
Right, right. Because you were you laid off it a long time.
Yes, 31 years, yeah.
Right. So was it the itch that, you know, brought you back? We were talking about this with Zoe earlier, with Fleetwood yeah. Mac, that they can't give up, you know? Was it? Did you feel that pull of playing music?
Well, I there's two things I'd say. I mean, obviously Everything But the Girl went on this kind of permanent hiatus in about 2000. Tracy decided she wanted to, you know, bring up family, and then when she returned, she went into a sort of solo career. And I felt I'd actually kept my performing years going in many ways, because although I've not been visible...
You were DJing.
Yeah, yeah, in the rock and pop world, you know, very much on the underground dance scene, I was very visible, you know, and was travelling a lot as a DJ, playing clubs and festivals. So that side of it never really died in me. I've always been a bit of a show off, you know. I like getting up on a stage and performing.
Your mother.
Exactly. And my dad in some ways, I think.
Yeah.
And I love that moment of interaction, you know, when the lights go down and you have to make something common happen between the two of you, the audience and the person on stage. I get a real thrill from that. But what I realised about 2 or 3 years ago was that I'd hit a bit of a wall with the DJing, and particularly running the label, which was exhausting, and that somehow my own creativity was not being satisfied, and I wanted to get back to words, which is why I started to write the book. And then that led to songs, and I realised that I wanted to play the guitar again and write. So I kind of hung up my headphones, as they say.
Because I was following you on Twitter, and I think you were starting to go to guitar shops, weren't you?
Yeah, that's
and
a bad sign, isn't it?
I could sense your excitement. That you felt you were allowed to buy a new guitar.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah.
it was about to be a professional undertaking again.
Yeah.
So,
and then I ran into Bernard Butler, which was another turning point. I actually went to a very fortuitous party in the back garden of the writer Pete Perfides, you know Pete?
Oh, yeah.
Who lives in Crouch End, who is throwing a summer party. And two things happened that night. One, Pete, who was doing the barbecue, said to me casually over a kebab, have you ever thought of going back and playing guitar like you did when you wrote Walter and John, which was quite an obscure track on my first 12-inch EP back in the early 80s. And I went, no, not really. And he said, well, I think there's a few people who'd really like to hear you play guitar like that again. And I walked away with my kebab, thinking, wow, Pete Perfides still remembers Summer Into Winter. And it actually meant quite a lot to me, because I respect Pete's opinion. And then I was introduced at the barbecue to Bernard Butler for the first time, who was a neighbour of Pete's down the road in Crouch
End. This is a huge set piece arranged by Perfides.
Probably, yes. Yeah.
He probably had all sorts of people. You're not Johnny Marr.
That's right. You're getting no barbecue sauce until you promise to get back on the road. That's right.
Yeah. And Bernard was there, and we started. It was very awkward. We sort of knew of each other and never met before. And we talked a bit. But in retrospect, I can look back and realise that it was quite an important moment for both of us. I was obviously getting this feeling that I wanted to get back to music in some way, having been a DJ for 10 years. And Bernard had been in the studio for 10 years as a producer, as a, you know, songwriter, playing guitar, but only on record. And I think he was feeling the urge to get back out in venues again and play live. And it was at that moment that we met, and we got together a couple of weeks after. I invited him over to my place to just play, and it was a disaster. We were really awkward with each other. We didn't know what to play. We were tiptoeing around each other. Bernard had broken his leg playing football and arrived with it in a cast, and he was a bit grumpy. And I thought, this isn't going to go anywhere. But in my heart, I felt that there was something there. And then a year later, I'd started to write the songs for Hendra. And I rang him up again and said, look, I've now got this idea. I've written all these folky, open-tuned, quite impressionistic things. And I want this darker voice. I want this kind of overdriven Mick Ronson, kind of Richard Thompson sound on the record. And I thought, you're the man to do it, Bernard. And I didn't actually... that's wrong. I didn't actually say that to him, but that was in my mind. And I went round to see him. And I said, what sort of thing would you play over these songs? And he said... He literally picked up a guitar while one of the demos was playing and played that kind of thing that he plays on the record, which is exactly what I wanted.
Perfect.
And I just went, Bernard, you know...
You got the job.
And we got married there and then.
Well, it's been a very happy comeback, because this won the Difficult Second Album Award recently.
It did, yes.
Do you get a prize for that? Do you
gives this Difficult Second Album Award?
It was the AIM Awards, Association of Independent Music,
yeah.
Which is in their fourth year now. I mean, it's a very, very good sort of industry body, and they've been very invisible, doing very good work for the independent sector for many years, and they've now set up an awards to make themselves a bit more visible. And this was their fourth year, and they've got a category which is Best Difficult Second Album to reward.
Brilliant idea.
So you've got a statuette, have you, or something?
I have a little robot, yes.
Okay. Well, let's hope that come, next year, whenever it is, November, that you have a Samuel Johnson Award to go with that, because it's richly deserved. That's all we got time for. I faithfully promise people they'll be home early.
Would you Ben please? Will be signing this book.
Ben
outside.
Will be signing his book out there,
yes,
for anybody who'd like
to. Please buy a copy. It is fantastic.
Please thank Ben Watt.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.